The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 6th of December, 2019. On the podcast today, Stephen Blythe, Chief Executive Officer of Expediator, XPD's ticker there, and Stephen discusses the highs and the lows from 2019 and what's to come in 2020. Also on the podcast, Bert Munro, soon to be CEO of Kora Gold, discusses their maiden resource at Sanankoro and also provides an update on Hummingbird Resources. Plus, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the Saudi Aramco IPO and OPEC's latest meeting. And as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, if you're wondering why they're important, the top five most followed, in fact, you can see top tens of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, but the top 10 most followed, these are companies people have been researching, maybe even buying shares in, okay? So there's an interest, there's something happening there. So always worth checking out. Now, I suggest if the share price has risen strongly in some of these companies, then ignore. Or maybe put them on your watch list for later, you know? It's all about the price. Now, if the share price hasn't risen and they're being followed, then, you know, do a bit of research. Think, why is it being followed? Yeah, it says money flowed. Follow the money. Also, top five or top 10 most liked RNSs. If you have received an RNS and you like the contents of that RNS, hit the thumbs up icon in the app there on that RNS, and it could be more widely shared. Why? Because it gets mentioned on this podcast, and also, of course, features on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Stephen Blythe, Chief Executive Officer of Expediator. XPD is a ticker there. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Yes, good morning.
Now we're going to go do a sort of a look back and a look forward as we're coming towards the end of the trading year. Before we do, as always, Stephen, if someone's not familiar, not aware of Expediator, could you just give a summary as to what the business is about, please?
Yeah, sure. We're a freight management company, and we're organised into three principal divisions. Freight forwarding, which is international freight forwarding with a particular emphasis on European road freight, although we are expanding our sea and air capability, mainly through acquisition. We have another division, which is our logistics division, which does warehousing, and also in that division is our Pallex entity. And in Romania, we have the one and only pallet network. And pleased to say, we've had two record months of over 70,000 pallets in each month. Really excited about where that's going for next year. And our third division is Affinity, where we have around about 2,000 truckers running 15,000 vehicles, and we supply them with services. So the average fleet size, 7 or 8 trucks. So we do the bulk buying, we sell on to them, and some of those customers on that division are also suppliers of our forwarding. And that's the symbiotic relationship we have within the group.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, so if we just take a breather here and look back at 2019, it's been quite challenging in certain sectors of the business. Now, what have you done to address these areas? Are they back on track to performing as you'd like, Stephen?
Yeah, well, we are a very diverse business, and you know, with nearly 1,000 people working in it in 12, 13 countries. So you've got to expect some things to negative things to happen sometimes as well as the good. So we're happy with how we're resolving some of the issues we've had. So the warehouse in the UK, we reconfigured that. So we had two largest customers moving on, but we've got new activity coming in. So I think we're quite well positioned to have that sorted out and ready for next year. So the cost we thought we were going to have in Q1 next year, we've effectively dragged it back into this year. We've got the new contract is in place with our regional subsidiary, and we're expecting that to ramp up in for next year. So those costs have already been taken. We've also our EMT company, unfortunately, suffered one or two casualties with Karen Millen going bust, Coast going bust, and the CBA with Arcadia. So the high street's been difficult and challenging, but we have got some new lines of activity going into EMT, and I'm expecting to make some announcements on that before Christmas. Some good contract wins are on that, which will be good. We have done a comprehensive review of our overheads, and we have spent a lot on IT and trying to get onto the e-forwarding page and developing that area of the business. And okay, the costs ran away with themselves a little bit. We're getting that back into check, but that is the future, and that's where we have to develop. And we've got Robert Ross is joining us. He will be working with Richard Meissen to review all of that area, and we're using external consultants to come in to give us the advice. It's a key area for us, and we will be spending money on IT. That is the future. We've had a year and a half now without doing any M&A. So we have got a full operating team in place. So Charlotte joined us as Group People Director. Robert Ross has joined us. We've got a new person who's joining us who's going to be COO Retail and Fashion, who we're hoping will bring quite a bit of business. And so we have a full team in place to hit 2020 right from the word go.
Yeah, and go on.
Yeah, and the last thing is our warehouse, which we took in Romania, which has been a bit of a problem in the last year. 53% occupancy into August. Okay, you lose money. I'm pleased to say we're not expecting that. Big turnaround. Occupation now up into the 85s, 90s. And that is not going to be losing over $500,000 as it did, as it will do this year. I'm expecting that to at least break even. So that's a big turnaround.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so are you saying next year will be growth, a year of growth?
Yes. We've actually had, and you'll see this in the market, strong top-line growth in sales. Some of the issues have been further down the line in certain areas. But we will continue to have strong organic growth. And we've got new partnerships that are coming in, and very excited about two things which we're doing in France. It's a bit like London buses, really. You wait a long time, and then three come along at the same time. And it's interesting, in this last couple of months, I've been talking to two good French companies, and we're going to do deals with both of them. So France for us next year will be a very, very good area. We're looking to ramp up the M&A again. We've had a year and a half without doing any, and got lots of deals in the pipeline to do, and some of these will be very good.
Excellent stuff. All right, and what, if you could point to a particular area you're most excited about in the business, what is it then, Stephen?
Well, the our pallets business continues to grow. We've got the one and only freight palletized network. That, in the last 2 months, has done over 70,000 pallets in each month. Mm-hmm. First year of operation, we did 46,000 pallets the whole year. And this is a sort of project where once you go through that break-even point on that curve, it just grows and grows and grows. So that is highly exciting. That is going to be the catalyst to grow more logistics. Very excited about the two new French partners that we've got coming in. Very excited about Affinity, where we've got some new lines of activity that we're looking to do. And I must say, Donna's done a fantastic job down there, and she's picked up on some suggestions I was making a long time ago, and she actually looks as if it's going to be delivered. So really excited about one of them. We've got an innovative offering we're going to be helping our customers with, and which is Affinity Factors. which we're white labelling with somebody, and this will be providing our affinity customers with the ability to factor individual debts. So we're not becoming a bank or anything, so the investors don't need to be alarmed about that. We're in between making commissions. But it's a good area for us to grow. I'm very excited about doing more M&A next year.
Yeah. And it's got to be pointed out, even though you had a challenging year, you still stated in the half-year reports, you know, that you're going to be doing about 200 million of revenue and 5 million of pre-tax profit. That's still on, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, even in a challenging year, you're still making a profit there and healthy growth. So that's good. So, now, listen, I've been noticing...
We've made profits on most years in the last 30-plus years.
Yeah.
So, and we've got net cash. So, it's a strong business. So we make money and we pay dividends.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I've been noticing, looking at R&S is now... since the middle of November, you've had 6 director purchases. So this reflects internal confidence, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. Wim and Charles welcomed onto the board. They've now had 2 meetings they've attended. And after the first meeting, they sought permission to be able to buy shares, which was granted. And so they've gone into the market. We as a family, we bought half a million shares in May. So we're very strongly behind this, and it's a good sign of confidence. And obviously, they know the full plans because they're sitting around the table listening to us outline them.
Yeah. Okay. Before I ask you for 3 reasons, then Stephen, I just want to quickly ask you, maybe further out ambitions. Where do you hope to be? Where do you hope to take Expediator?
Well, the target which I've said to people, which I still want to try to achieve, is within 3 years to have a half a billion turnover and within 5 a billion. But more importantly, that bottom line getting to 20 million plus and 40 million plus. And, there are various people I'm talking to, and if some of these things came off, I would I'd achieve the 3-year one very comfortably.
Marvelous stuff.
But we'll see what happens. And the thing with M&A activity is it takes you a long time to talk to people and to cement deals.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, 3 reasons then, Stephen. If someone's listening to this, like the sound of the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, just give them those 3 reasons why they should add you to their watch list, please.
Well, we've got some very exciting new initiatives we're doing, which when they come off, I'm going to really enjoy telling the market about it. And we've got some sound and good organic growth, as well as being in a sector which is ripe for consolidating what is a highly fragmented market. And so there'll be no shortage of deals for us to do. Of different sizes, and we don't mind them working and doing 10 deals, smaller deals, rather than one big one. So if it's right and it fits to what we want to do, we'll do it. As I said before, we make money and we pay dividends. So anybody investing, if they want dividends, we're going to be doing that as well as capital growth. And we've got some... there's some good areas that we're looking to develop, which will be very exciting for us and add to the bottom line. And we have been around for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. So this is not a new startup. This is a solid business which has been around for a long time, growing. And lastly, Brexit, if it ever happens, we make money on. So investors don't need to be worried about that. When it happens, at the ports and the airports and everything, we are ready for customs clearances.
Yeah.
So we're Brexit-proof, and 60% plus of what we do is in Europe anyway. So whereas the UK may be leaving, as a business, we're not.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Stephen, good to chat to you, and hopefully... like I say, bits of news coming out soonish. So hopefully we'll be chatting in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Oh, great. Have a good Christmas.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Bert Munro, soon to be the CEO of Cora Gold at C-O-R-A. Bert, thanks for joining me.
Not at all. Thanks for having me on, Justin.
Yeah, well, especially thanks for joining me considering you were a little bit under the weather. I assume you went out. Did you go out to, was it Mali or somewhere, and got bitten by a dodgy mosquito or something?
Yeah, I think that might be the case. Yeah, I was out on site 2 weeks ago, and I think I've got a little bit of dengue fever, but shouldn't be too bad. Just feel a bit under the weather for a few days.
Well, anyway, thanks for coming on. But let's, first of all, before we get into the news, because you've had a maiden resource announced, and so that's a bit of big news to dig into. Just for people not quite familiar with Cora Gold, could you just summarise what it's about, please? Obviously, there's a hint in the title there, but give us the operations, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. Cora Gold is an AIM-listed gold explorer. It's got a suite of permits across predominantly Mali, but also into Senegal as well. So in two highly prospective gold regions, both the Yanfolila Belt, which obviously hosts the Yanfolila gold mine of Hummingbird, as well as a number of other big deposits such as Kalana for Endeavour and Kabada for African Gold Group. And then we've also got a suite of permits in the Kenieba window as well, which has got some of the biggest mines in West Africa. So having permits amongst the majors and the big producers is an exciting time for Cora to be drilling and doing exploration.
Yeah, and like I said, there is a connection, isn't it, between Hummingbird and Cora. I mean, Hummingbird are a big shareholder in Cora, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Hummingbird's got an 18% position in Cora. Ultimately, around half of the permits which Cora currently has were historically Hummingbird permits. Mm-hmm. When Hummingbird moved into the construction phase, it was aware that ultimately it wasn't going to do justice to some of its exciting regional permits whilst it was focusing on construction and gearing up into operations. So Hummingbird did a deal with Cora, which was a private company run by John Forster, who's got an amazing track record of making discoveries across West Africa. And ultimately, we put those permits together. And on the back of that, obviously, Cora has been going ahead with exploration.
Yeah, lovely guy, John. He's a geologist at heart, isn't he? He loves it. He's got a passion for it. And I mean, he is sort of stepping down from the CEO and you becoming a CEO next year. But I've got a feeling, to be a CEO, you're a bit of a salesman as well, you know, sometimes. And John just seems to me like he just loves the geology part, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think John is, he's an out-and-out explorer. He's made a number of discoveries which have gone on to be producers. As you say, he's stepping down at the end of this year, really. So he's turning 65, and he's going to remain as head of exploration next year. So he'll obviously remain in charge of the technical side of the business and looking to obviously grow the discovery and prove up other discoveries as well. So obviously I'm going to be into that. Obviously, an important part of being a listed company is the corporate side and marketing the business, and that's obviously what I've been focused on predominantly at Hummingbird for the last 6 or 7 years in my role as business development at Hummingbird.
Yeah, we'll have an update on Hummingbird in a few minutes. Before we do, let's get into this maiden resource at Sanankoro. So take us through that then, if you could, Bert.
Yes, I mean, look, we've been... Yeah, we had the discovery at Cora for the last couple of years. We've been drilling it quite a lot this year, and ultimately we brought it into a maiden resource. I think the important thing to say on this maiden resource is twofold. One, it's a pit constrained maiden resource, so ultimately it hopefully gives a good indication that the ounces which are in that inferred resource will be mineable, and you'll be getting the majority of those ounces into a mine plan, which is exciting. I think we always said with this maiden resource, we were targeting the ability to show sort of starter pit potential, not the a full sort of life of mine potential. So what you've got is the resource from under 25% of the mineralized structures within the permit area, and also limited by depth as well. So I think for me, it shows a good starting point, but certainly by no means the true potential of the project area. So for us, we're currently fully funded and already drilling with two rigs, which should increase to four drill rigs by the end of next week, I would have thought, on the permit area, looking to obviously expand that potential and build it out even further. So I think it's a good start, but I think it's by no means the potential of the permit area.
Yeah, and I mean, John does say in the RNS, doesn't he, the estimate is the first step in defining the overall oxide potential at the project, where to date less than a quarter of the 1 to 2 million ounce SRK exploration target has been tested. So there's still more to come here. Just a good start.
Yeah, and I think that word oxide, I think, is important. I think, you know, the oxide material there is very deep, up to 100 metres, sometimes a little bit over 100 metres in parts. And your oxide ore is ultimately, you know, a free digging, free milling type of ore. So, you know, you should be able to mine it cheaply and also process it cheaply. So for us, having a deep zone of oxide is very exciting. There's, you know, lots of examples in West Africa and other places where you have, you know, significantly lower grade oxide operations which are very profitable. So you know, the 1.6 grams a ton we've got currently, you know, is actually a good number for oxide operation, and should be able to turn into very profitable dirt for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what's next then after this? What's the next milestone you're hoping to achieve here then, Bert?
Yeah, we're also due to deliver an initial scoping study this year. So obviously you've only got a couple of weeks left. So as it stands, we are due to complete the scoping study. Once again, a bit like the maiden resource, it's really, you know, a proof of concept showing that there's economic potential to this gold, and just to show that there is, you know, to justify stepping out and continuing wider exploration. So as it stands, we're due to do that. Also, as I just mentioned, we're drilling pretty aggressively at the moment on the permit, so certainly come the new year we should be getting plenty of drill results coming out, which we should be putting out to the market. So I hope for a junior company, we've got plenty of good news flows to be putting out in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, okay. Well, before we get on to the three reasons, let's have a quick update on Hummingbird. I've just seen an RNS pop up actually as Holder increasing their stake here. So what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, that RNS was just on Sustainable Capital increasing their holding, which is a great show of support. They're our largest shareholder and obviously just got a little bit larger. Just briefly on Hummingbird, I think operationally it's going very well. We've had two good months in this Q4 so far, and obviously looking forward to having a third good month this quarter. So I think hopefully Hummingbird looks to be ending the year strongly in a similar vein to how it performed in Q3, or slightly better, I hope. Mm-hmm. So I think operationally things are going great. I think there's been a little bit of frustration probably from some holders around a slightly weak share price, which for me is a little bit unexplained. I think ultimately we've been delivering operationally and are very pleased with how things are going. So unsure why there's been that slight sort of weakness in the share price, but ultimately the fundamentals of the business are very good at the moment.
Yeah, do you think it's tied? I mean, obviously it's tied to the gold price a little bit, which has had a nice rally. Like I said, in May, June, summertime, it broke out of its range. It's been in for a long time. It broke above $1,300, you know, an ounce there. And it rallied to $1,560. In fact, it rallied $200 pretty much. And now it's consolidating a bit. But it seems like a floor is at $1,450. I think, honestly, yeah, Next year, if there's any sign of global slowdown, and there's suggestions there will be, I think this will rally again. You know, I think this is just a start of a rally in gold, don't you?
Well, yeah, no, obviously, yeah, no, I mean, definitely, I agree with you there. I mean, if you look at, you know, how much money Eric Sprott, for example, you know, the biggest gold investor around, is putting into gold companies at the moment and over the last year, I mean, he's certainly believing the gold price has got a hell of a long way to go. So I think there's a lot of positive indications for the gold price. I mean, as ever, Hummingbird and I guess all gold companies are really, you know, focused on delivering as many ounces as you can as cheaply as possible, because you can't do anything about the gold price, sadly. But yes, I mean, fundamentally, I think the gold price will be, you know, as a minimum where it is now, if not higher next year. So that bodes very well for Hummingbird investors, yeah, you know, geared right into that gold price, because with deleveraging extremely quickly, you know, should be net cash during next year comfortably, and obviously kicking off good free cash flow per quarter.
Yeah, and let's be honest, every central bank pretty much is printing money, you know, devaluing the traditional currencies. So in that situation, especially if you've got a slowing economy, slow, you know, people invest in safe haven assets, and gold is the king of the safe haven assets. So I think generally the macro outlook is looking very good, you know, but there we are.
Yeah, certainly. I bought a little bit of physical gold myself last month. So yeah, no, I'm certainly still a believer in it.
I don't know why, then. I had a picture of you having a hands full of sovereign rings.
I actually, that's not quite true, but I did. I have a few Hummingbird 1 ounce coins, actually, but we had our second daughter this year, and I only had one of them one of the specific hummingbird ones. So I thought I'd better get a second one for the other daughter. Otherwise, you know, in 20 years' time, there'll be one will be jealous of the other one. So but I got a few Britannias as well. But I did buy another hummingbird coin last month.
Marvellous. Okay, well, three reasons then. If someone likes the sound of what's happening at Cora Gold, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons, Bert, why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, sure thing. So the first one I'd say is we've just published a maiden resource, which shows a great start to the project, and obviously currently due to deliver a scoping study pretty imminently, which shows good progression with the project. Secondly, fully funded through a significant drill program we're currently doing, both on San and Coro and also on some other regional projects as well. And thirdly, we have a wide land package as well. So whilst the focus has been on San and Coro, we've got some really exciting other permits, such as Medina Full Bay in the Kenny-Eba window, Tekeladugu Dam, which is right beside the Amphalila mine as well. So I think, you know, Cora's got a suite of assets, which certainly in Q1 we're looking to do some slightly more exploration work on them on top of the work which has been focused on San and Coro in this Q4.
Marvellous stuff, Bert. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, it's very good.
Have you got your Christmas tree up yet?
Oh, you're kidding? It's been up for 2 weeks.
You're kidding me.
Well, the kids, I had a fight to bring that
dead by Christmas Day.
I had a fight to bring that deadline to, you know, closer to Christmas. They wanted it even earlier. I said, well, listen, you know, 25th of November, and then it's a month. They wanted it a week before that. I said, no. I'm not going to need more than a month before Christmas.
For goodness sake.
Yeah.
We're getting hours this weekend, by the way. So you're making me feel like a bad dad now.
Yeah, but it's because of our kids. But I mean, essentially, I think your children are older than mine. But
12 and 10.
Yeah, exactly. Mine's 6 and 9. So the 6-year-old was crying when I said, no, we're not putting it up. You know, on the 18th of November. So it seems like
I shouldn't laugh. Sorry.
It's funny. I'm hearing Christmas tunes now, and people start like yourself saying we're going to put our Christmas tree up this weekend. I thought, really? And I feel like every year a bit behind the curve, but no, it's just we are very, very early, you know. But
I fear you have shot out the traps very promptly. I wouldn't. I mean, your vacuum cleaners will be very busy with needles even before Christmas Day. I reckon.
Okay. All right.
But there we go.
Let's talk oil first of all. I know you've been looking at the OPEC meeting and all that stuff. I want to touch on Saudi Aramco, which is now. Is it the biggest company in the world, or biggest listed company in the world, isn't it?
It is now the biggest listed company in the world. It listed on the Saudi exchange in Riyadh. The pricing's been set, so I think the listing will be the week beginning, the actual listing and trading will begin the week of the 9th of December. It's priced, so the actual value of the IPO was $25.6 billion, which means it's the biggest deal ever, just ahead of Alibaba, which I think is something that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was obviously keen to achieve from a kudos perspective. What he didn't get, however, was his allegedly desired $2 trillion valuation for the company. It's going to work out at about $1.7 trillion. The free float's around 1.5%. Now, he wanted $2 trillion. Yeah. And if you were reading the discussions in the FT and reading to London fund managers and talking to London fund managers myself, and we actually did a piece of work on it as well, the international investment community was saying, look, no, 1.2 to 1.5 trillion.
Okay.
The Saudis wanted two. And it seems as if they've lent primarily on domestic demand. So where do you get those numbers from? Well, the company made annual profit last year of $100 billion US dollars, from memory, having a quick look at the prospectus. And the company is promising an annual dividend of $75 billion US. So $75 billion into $2 trillion, well, you can do the maths for yourself. It's a yield of about, 3.5% or something. If you look at the major oil majors like Shell, BP, Chevron, Conoco, Total of France, Eni of Italy, Repsol of Spain, and even chucking the Russians like Gazprom or Rosneft, then they generally yield 4, 5, 6, 7%. So you were talking about Saudi Aramco coming out with a much lower yield. So if you were to say, well, we'll put them on an international benchmark yield of, say, 6%, that's roughly where you get the sort of 1.2 trillion valuation from. If you go up all the way to 3, 3.5, all the way down to a yield of 3, 3.5, that's where you get the 2 trillion from. Now, you're clearly bearing the same risk with Aramco as you are with the others, i.e. the oil price and the gas price could go down. You've also got additional, and you've obviously got the ESG push against hydrocarbon risk, and the danger that some of their 261 billion barrels in the ground are actually left to stranded assets. You've clearly got geopolitical risk, given that this is a Middle Eastern-based company. They've had drone attacks this year. And you've got to buy into the Saudi Prince MBS reform angle. On the plus side, there are things that speak in the company's favour. It's massive. It's wildly profitable. It's got these huge reserves of 261 billion barrels. It's got an incredibly low cost of production, probably the lowest in the world. So if the oil price does go down, that is something that's in your favour. And it's got no debt. So there are pluses and minuses. But for me, you know, if it was my money, at 1.2 I'd have been trillion, I'd have been really interested because the yield's 6-7%. At 2 trillion, not interested at all. 1.7, it's kind of a meh. Now, there is at some stage going to be a secondary listing, I believe. London, New York, Singapore, let's see, which will take the float up. The other thing that I guess people will be looking for is it's going to go into the Tadawul Index. There are ETFs and passive funds that track that. There will be an element of captive demand there. It's going to be a huge chunk of the Tadawul Index, I think possibly more than 50%. So that will help as well. But we'll now see. But the 75 billion dividend is a huge lure. But I think at a lower valuation, it'd have been an even bigger one.
Yeah, well, what's half a trillion between friends? Listen, I've got to say, the thing is here, what I don't understand is Saudi Arabia, the kingdom there, very secretive, you know, and like I said, state-owned oil company.
Yeah.
So the question is, I mean, they've only, like I said, a free float there, I think you said before we came on.
1.5%.
Yeah, 1.5%. And what, in London usually, you need to, what, 25%?
To go into an index, you've got to have a 25% free float, yes. Now, I think the Financial Conduct Authority rewrote its rules to make an exception for large sovereign controlled companies, and I think it said that the minimum would be 5%, because that was Saudi Arabia's initial goal, but it hasn't even got there. And frankly, the FCA rewriting its rules to try and grab some fees, I thought was pretty shameful anyway.
Yeah, it is. It's just basically money talks. It's like, if you've got the money, we'll change the law. That's the rules we stand by, we don't care.
From a regulator that is there to protect consumers and investors, and to say with one side of its mouth, we're here to protect you, the other side of its mouth, actually, we're going to bend our rules so we can grab a few quid, I think looked terrible.
But it's like, we have our rules. Oh, hang on a second. 1.7 trillion. We'll change the rules, don't worry.
I can assure you they do have their rules, because my employer has to abide by them. We all do as employees. But I can equally, when you know we're working very hard to abide by those rules, to then see the regulator change them just so there could be if there's some fees involved. That was very disappointing to me personally.
So let me ask you at the end. So the listing this company, now we all know when companies go to a listing, go to public, they do it to raise money generally. So I mean, we all regard to Saudi and that this is the most profitable oil company around, like you say. Why are they raised? What do they need to raise money then? What's going on there?
It's part of Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reform policy in Saudi Arabia. He's looking to raise the money to fund welfare programs, to fund investment, to fund the development of alternative industries so that the kingdom can diversify away from hydrocarbons, and the view that on a long-term view, the world may well continue to move away from them. So it's very much to fund the country rather than the company, because as you say, the company has got no debt. Mm. You're right. One of the questions that you've got to ask on a governance perspective is, how can I make sure that management and the key shareholders' interests, i.e. Saudi Arabia, are aligned with mine as a minority shareholder? And that's a relationship that we'll obviously see how it develops over time. We've got the OPEC meeting in Vienna right now, where Saudi Arabia seems to be pushing for oil production cuts to support the oil price, which means that Aramco will actually be producing a little bit less oil than perhaps forecast would have been expecting previously. So again, you're already looking at potentially differing agendas. I guess the Saudi theory will be lower volumes means higher price, so net, no problem. But it's clearly, you know, you are going to get involved in wider issues than simply the day-to-day running of the company in an efficient manner to get the stuff out the ground as cheaply and quickly and efficiently as it can.
Yeah. Well, I think, let's be honest, they're right to probably diversify, because most governments around the world now have a line in the sand as to when they'll stop allowing sort of,
you know, 2050 seems to be the sort of carbon neutral.
Yeah, exactly.
It won't be used, but equally you would expect that, you know, there will be other things being promoted more vigorously. I mean, that's why Dubai has gone through the 20-year economic reform program. It's gone under Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum. And, you know, Qatar, UAE, they're all working on similar plans to develop new industries, attract tourism, invest internationally to make sure that one day they're not sat on either a lot of stranded assets that nobody wants, or indeed you know, empty all the wells that are finally being exhausted, which admittedly, again, is a long time away, but it's something that you're clearly seeing. And I think one of the things, you know, with the rise of ESG investing, there is greater awareness of whether everybody's comfortable investing in hydrocarbons. I think some investors will take the view, look, I invest my money to protect it from inflation or to generate additional wealth, and at the right price, at the right time, they would view hydrocarbons as a part of that. Some people may take the view, actually, I don't wish to be involved, and put them in the bucket with possibly other industries like, you know, gambling or tobacco or even alcohol, and that's a matter of personal preference. Some people will be very hard-nosed about it. It's about making money. Yeah. Some people will be less hard-nosed about it. I want to make money, protect my money in what I feel is the right way, and that's a matter of personal choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's be honest, it's an industry in decline, surely, over the long term. But looking forward, I mean, I know they're trying to protect this by you know, altering the supply, and you mentioned there was an OPEC meeting recently. What's the outcome of that, then?
Well, they're still negotiating. I mean, the Financial Times is reporting the Saudis are pressing for another 500,000 barrel a day production cut. Mm-hmm. Now, OPEC, a couple of years ago in Vienna, cut production by about 800,000 barrels a day. It got the Russians to chip in with a 400,000 barrel a cut. That's 1.2 million barrels. Global oil demand, if you look at the OPEC document, it's monthly, it's fascinating. If you're an oil spod, you can download it for free. It says that global oil demand this year has increased by around 1% to 2% to roughly 100 million barrels a day. That's an increase of about 1 to 2 million barrels. And the Saudis have cut production, and OPEC Plus, as it were, Saudi Arabia and OPEC Plus Russia, have cut production by about 1.2. The problem that you've got is that US shale production has now crossed the 9 million barrels a day mark for the first time. That's an increase of over a million barrels. So as fast as OPEC cuts, American production increases, and that's generally why, even though you've had OPEC production cuts, you've had a collapse in Venezuelan production, you've had American sanctions basically cutting Iran out of the market, and that's knocked out 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day, you've still got an oil price that's going absolutely nowhere. Now, the good news is that oil demand, okay, good news if you're OPEC, bad news if you're Greta Thunberg or a green voter or somebody who wants to see hydrocarbon demand reduced. Hydrocarbon demand is still growing at its general steady 1% to 2% rate. It's generally a supply-driven market. Oil demand, I think, dropped year on year once this century so far. And from memory, I'm thinking it's 2008 or 2009, when, let's face it, demand for a lot of things was falling. So it's generally not a demand-driven market. It's generally a supply-driven market. The big dynamic here is shale. Now, the UK is banned fracking just when it was getting going, which I think from an environmental point of view, the UK is in a different place from America. You know, if you're drilling near Blackpool, it's very, or Sussex, in the middle of Sussex, it's very, very different if you're drilling in the middle of Wyoming, where, or North Dakota, where frankly there isn't anybody. But even then, you do have Senator Warren in America running for the Democratic ticket. She said if she's president of the United States on November the 4th, 2020, she's going to ban fracking. So you can still see there are some variables here, but right now, it does look as if American shale demand is still rising very sharply. The one thing that could cut that off perversely is a big drop in oil prices, because a lot of these shale drillers, they're junk bond funded, they're heavily indebted. There is a survey whose name has just temporarily eluded me. It's something like the Haynes survey in America, and it tracks how many oil explorers have gone bust. And the number this year I've got in my head is 33. Which is up from about 18 last year from memory, and that's with a relatively flat oil price. So an oil price drop could actually, in theory, shake some of these people out. Equally, it would put a lot of pressure on OPEC's own finances, and so they probably don't view that as too easy. So they're in a bit of a rock and a hard place. And if the oil price goes up too much, some guy called Trump starts tweeting, as we saw last year. So they are trying to achieve the right balance between funding their welfare programs, getting the dollars coming in, and yet not drive the oil price up too much or let it fall too sharply. Even if an oil price fall, could actually shake out US shale to quite a spectacular degree. The other thing to note is, although the US rig count is down to around 800 and odd active rigs at the moment in the States, down from a peak of way over 1,000, shale activity is still high because productivity per rig has gone up very, very rapidly over the last 3 or 4 years. And this is the tricky thing with commodity investing generally. To bet on sustained increases in commodity prices is to bet against human ingenuity, because we've been very, very good as a race at getting better yields from crops, making more productive oil rigs, whatever it is. And over time, we've been able to meet demand through ingenuity. So there are always spikes in these things, but over time, the human race has been pretty good at producing them in greater volumes.
Yeah. And what year is the tipping point? Year on year, all demand has always grown. Mm. When is it expected to decline then? Does anyone know or what?
No, I mean, because obviously we on all the peak oil arguments have all sort of, you know, disappeared from in terms of peak oil production. That's all been thrown out the ash into the ash can because of things like shale, and again just superior technology and people able to drill deeper offshore, for example Mexico, Brazil, Africa. I'm not aware of that. What I would say with alternative energy sources is that it's going to be one of those classic S curves that Bill Gates talked about. It's going to take the start of the S is going to be a lot shallower and longer than you think. But once you hit a certain threshold, the S will suddenly develop a lot more steeply and rapidly than you think. Yeah. So I suspect if you are invested in the hydrocarbons, you're probably going to get a longer run at it with your fat, juicy dividend yields than most people would expect or perhaps like.
Yeah.
But once there is a tipping point reached, it'll probably happen a lot quicker. I mean, there are still, you know, even green technologies, there's not a completely free lunch here. Mm. You still need steel to make solar panels sit up straight. You still need steel to make wind turbines. How do you make steel? Well, you can't make it without coking coal. Okay, we can maybe do without thermal coal, but you still need coking coal. So you still need coal, so you still need to get the filthy stuff out of the ground, and you still need to burn it. And in the end, yes, you've got an electric car, and you plug it into the network, but where does the electricity come from? Does it come from a nuclear power plant, a coal-fired power plant, a biomass plant? So it's not a complete free lunch solution, but clearly if we were, for example, to all be able to start driving on electric cars, you would think that would bring many benefits in some ways. But equally, then where does the lithium come from? Is it the Democratic Republic of Congo? Is it Chile? Is it an ethical source? What the hell do you do with the batteries when the things are exhausted in 10 years time because they're chock full of chemicals? So again, there are still some questions to be addressed there that mean this is a lot more complex than unfortunately we'd all probably like it to be.
Okay, and that forward guidance of like 500,000 barrels cut, is that normally accurate as to what actually happens then?
Oh, well, that's a brilliant question. The Saudis have generally borne the brunt of the recent production cuts all on their own because there has been a bit of backsliding. Russians have actually been very good at sticking to their forecast, but OPEC's history is very much one of talking about one thing but not necessarily sticking to it. I mean, Qatar, for example, pulled out of OPEC last year partly because they were being frozen out on a geopolitical basis. But again, relying on them implicitly to stick to their promises, you've got to be fairly brave, I think.
Yeah. Okay, marvellous stuff. Any other thoughts, Russ?
I think that's it. I mean, I think it obviously, you know, BP and Shell shareholders will be watching this with considerable interest. I mean, they are now both planning, for $50 oil. So that, you know, we'll see whether that is tested or not. But right now, operating free cash flow is covering the dividend yield, which it wasn't 3 years ago. So they've cut their cloth. And, you know, they have money. And even when the oil price was down, they managed to bodge their way through by cutting capex, selling off assets, and using debt to fund the dividends. Mm. They can't do that forever. Their debts are towards the top end of their historic range. They've sold a lot of assets. You can't cut capex forever because you're weakening your competitive position. So if there is another dip down to, say, $30 for any reason, that would probably put more pressure on them to, you know, to fund the dividend. I'm sure, again, they do their best to work through that. Shell hasn't cut its dividend since at least 1945. BP's done it twice since 1990, so it has form. But I think at the moment, those dividends are probably a bit safer than perhaps people might care to think. On the electric vehicle side, Tesla, can't get my head around the share price, can't get my head around the accounting, can't get my head around the guy who runs it. Genuinely hope that he succeeds. Don't personally take to him very much because of the way in which he conducts himself and the stock, I find a bit of a box of tricks. If you are looking for an enterprise, an electric vehicles play in the UK, TI Fluid Systems, I think, is very, very much flying below the radar. People view it as being a hydrocarbon fluids play, partly because of its name, but it's actually got terrific EV technology. And if you actually look at EV cars, they still need a lot of coolants in there, and that is one of TI Fluid Systems' specialities. So that may be an underestimated stock if the EV revolution really kicks off, and might be one worthy of further research because it's still on very low multiples with a decent yield. It is an ex-private equity deal, which will make some people think twice, because ex-PE deals have a bit of a roachy reputation, and to a degree with some legitimate reason. But it does seem to be a stock with a company with more interesting technology than people perhaps give it credit for.
Yeah, okay. And the ticker there is TIFS.
TIFS. Yeah, marvellous stuff. FTSE 250.
Marvellous. Thanks for that, Russ. And
enjoy dancing around the tree.
No, I'm sick of that now. I'm already, you know, Christmas is out. I'm a bit weary of it. So speak next week, Russ.
I look forward to it.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. GST Technologies up 12.9% from 0.175. At four, Tissue Regenics Group, that's TRX, down 10.4% at 1.075. At three, Richland Resources down 11.76% to 0.015. At two, Oracle Power up 17.2% to 0.5458 pence. And number one most followed is down 12.5% to 0.035. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Infrastrata, award of contract. At four, Armadale Capital, appointment of non-executive director. At three, Hummingbird Resources, notification of major holding. At two, Kalahari Metals Limited, Botswana drilling update. And number one most liked RNS was Kibo Energy update, reorganization of Botswana interests. That's it for the podcast. Oh, by the way, do you know what I like? I've been accumulating a stock and it hasn't featured in the top 10 most followed for a long time. I quite like that. When a stock is under the radar. I may be revealing what the stock is on the weekend podcast or my weekend video. I've been accumulating, you know what I'm saying? That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.